Hezekiah is trying to make an alliance with Egypt, and it's not going to work. But second thing, where is the true deliverance found, and where did it actually see its accomplishment? Here we're talking about where it's going to be found, but in the next chapters we'll talk about the actual reality of it. It is what? Always God, isn't it? True deliverance is always found in the Lord, and that's something we need to depend upon and we need to recognize as well. Okay, we had a special time that we talked about in question number 5 that I wanted to review, and that is what caused the people, including the religious leaders, I would say especially the religious leaders, to do wrong or to err. What was it? What influence was it? Question number 5, it's in chapter 28 in verse 7 of the text. The wine, yeah, the wine. And you'll remember we talked about that, the problems that are found, and we can see it. This is something I'm going to talk about in our third lesson when we talk about modesty. The world understands that drinking is a vice. The world understands the trouble you can get in from drink. The world really doesn't care all that much. And so the idea of accountability, the idea of these evils, and they're willing to risk it pretty much because they enjoy it, they like it. But we understand that's not good. It's not good for a Christian for sure. Not good for an elder. It's not good for the leaders of a people. I was thinking about it. I don't want to get too political, but it is kind of an interesting thing what happened with regard to the last debate, the political debate that happened. And I've said it enough so that you know that I'm not a fan of either man. But it was interesting that vacant stare and the fumbling that Biden was suffering from as a result of that. And the reason for that very possibly is a lack of mental acuity due to early onset of either some senile problems or other mental deficiencies that come. That's what happens with drink. You know, if you see the stumbling, the inability to answer coherently, all of those kinds of things, that's exactly what he's talking about here. They're making bad decisions. They don't know what they're doing. They're stumbling about because they're drunk, because they're at the wine. And that's not good for the people, the leaders of the people of Israel and Judah here at this particular time. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Question number 12. What did Isaiah would happen to Ariel or Jerusalem? What is the inevitable thing that's going to happen? Okay, not brought down on this particular occasion, although it eventually would, but what was going to happen to the city? It could be besieged. And it actually did, if we look at it. On this occasion, God's intervention was able to basically overcome the siege. This was a superior army that was coming, that was going to seek to destroy Ariel or Jerusalem, just like it had destroyed all the other cities that it had come across. And so that was what was going to happen. A siege would be laid around it. And then in question 13, what would happen to those nations who fight against it, or the nations or nation that lay siege to it? What is said there? In 29 verses 7 through 8 of the text. The defeat, they would be defeated. But it is an interesting thing is that the defeat is not going to be normal, is it? It's not going to be that the city's going to be able to throw fire down on top of those who lay siege to it, or the archers or whatever to defeat the army. 185,000 soldiers were killed on this particular occasion. That's a lot of soldiers, 185,000. At every gate, surrounding the city, not letting anyone in, not letting anyone out. In Texas history, some of you are not from Texas, but a lot of us, we grew up being indoctrinated about the Alamo. Remember the Alamo? And it was really a dire, dire situation because you had all of Santa Anna's army just gathered around this and laying siege to the Alamo, and just a few hardy individuals on the inside, and all of them lost their life because there simply was not enough not enough people to stop the surge when the surge finally happened. And they killed a lot of the Mexican soldiers, but the fact was they were overrun as a result of the sheer numbers. And that's kind of the situation we had here on this particular occasion. But God came to their aid, and that's why Assyria was defeated. Okay, question number 16. Through all of these judgments and chastisements, the question is this: what did the future hold for the house of Jacob, as indicated in chapter 29, verses 17 through 24? The restoration. Yes, the recovery or restoration. There would be that remnant that would return, that could worship God, hallow God, as the answer is given, and fear God of Israel. So it wasn't completely total destruction. And we see again the interesting thing about this, and it becomes especially evident in our next section in chapters 36 through 39, which show the fulfillment of the prophecies. Because remember, Isaiah prophesied at the beginning of this coming of Assyria before it happened, but all the way through to the time of Babylon, or nearer to when. In other words, he was the prophet that was prophesying during the time when what he said was going to happen about Assyria actually did happen to Assyria. So we see the fulfillment of those things within this prophecy. If you read 2 Kings 18, chapters 18 and 20, and you read Isaiah chapter 36 through 39, you're going to find an awful lot of repetitive and familiar material in there, because the story is told twice and it's very, very similar in each telling as to what actually did happen. But we do know when we go to Ezra and Nehemiah that a remnant indeed did return and turn back to worshiping God. And that's a reference that is made. But ultimately, keep in mind that the messianic fulfillment is the ultimate fulfillment of these things. Because we today are the spiritual remnant. When we talk about the seed and the stump that would return to God, and we see it happening in Ezra and Nehemiah when the city was rebuilt, where the walls were built, the temple was built, worship again was restored, that's not the ultimate fulfillment of the fact that God protects his elect. The ultimate fulfillment is that which comes in the messianic kingdom, of which we are the remnant. Now, we are the elect. We are the chosen, and that's the ultimate fulfillment about this. Okay, we already, I think, talked a little bit about question 17, upon whom were the rebellious children of Israel placing their trust, and that was Egypt, whose help would be in vain. It wasn't going to help them, but God indeed would. Question 19 is, God sifted the nations with the sieve of futility. Remember that the judgments that we've been talking about through this series is all of the world at that time because of the evil that is there. But when that sieve of futility was brought about and the nations were judged and sifted, what nation in particular was beaten down? Ultimately destroyed. It was Assyria. It's a neat thing about the way God works. And again, the prophets had to understand that. Israelites had to understand it. Yes, you are my chosen people, but you've done wrong, so I'm going to judge you. Well, they're worse than we are. Well, maybe so, and they'll get their comeuppance later, but I'm using them to punish you. And that's exactly, again, what did happen. Assyria would fall, not by the sword of man, but rather they would flee with fear because of God and what God would do to them, which we'll read about in these next chapters. Let's see here. Okay, a couple more questions. How is the sovereignty of God depicted in the 34th chapter? This is question number 33, and the text is 34 and verses 1 through 4. How is it that we know that God is in control, as indicated by this text? Is it not because what he has stated with regard to the judgment of the nations actually indeed would and did take place? I mean, you think about this, as God is so great and so powerful And using Assyria as an example, when we look at this next section, when you have the cupbearer of the king that comes out and says, Sennacherib is coming, pay him tribute. If you give yourself willingly, we're going to send you away from your home, but we're going to take care of you. We're going to give you provisions until we take you away, and destroy everything. But we're going to be, you would say good to you, but you're not going to utterly die, is what he was basically saying. But all of these gods throughout this land that all the people depended upon, they all fell because the king of Sennacherib is greater than them all, and he's greater than the Lord as well. But it didn't happen that way, did it? Because God is truly sovereign. People question that today. And I would like again to describe this and contrast this with maybe the gods that you see that are figments of men's imaginations, whether they be the pagan gods of the Greeks, the Romans, or others of other nations, Baal, as we talked about in 1 Kings 18, all of those kinds of examples of just how ineffectual they were compared to God. You read Acts chapter 17, it's a wonderful message by the Apostle Paul to the Greeks, saying you've got all these gods out here, but the one that you're missing out on is the one I want to proclaim to you, and he's a God, doesn't need us. He has blessed us with our creation, but he doesn't need the efforts of men to exist or to prosper. He's God. He's the one that created all things. He's the reason why we are here. He is great. He is sovereign, and he is in control. He's the one in charge of the rise and fall of nations and the boundaries, how big they get or how small they are, the boundaries of their habitations. That's God, and you can try to fight against him, but it's not going to work, and we need to know that today as well. It's certainly applicable to our lives as well as we seek to serve him. And so his sovereignty is something that is established by the judgment on the nations. But in chapter 35, in the first 10 verses, we find another way in which the sovereignty of God is depicted. And what is that?
The glory of Zion.
The glory of Zion, yeah. And the fact that Zion would have that ability to be saved. The God, here are the Assyrians, this evil and horrible nation is coming against the city of Jerusalem, and yet because God is sovereign, those are his people. And those people indeed would be protected, which again gives us as the fulfillment of that in the Messianic kingdom, this recognition is that we don't have to fear. That's what we talked about in the first hour. There's no reason for us to be afraid because God is on our side. God is on our side. Man cannot defeat us. So the sovereignty of God is depicted there by his salvation for glorious Zion. And then the last one is chapter 36. How shall the ransomed of the Lord return to Zion? That's stated in chapter 35 and verse 10, which is what? Return in song, correct? Singing with everlasting joy and gladness. I wanted to bring that up simply because we have default states that we find ourselves in, and it's very much dependent for Christians upon whether or not we are serving God acceptably or not, whether or not our lives are in accord with his will. And the way it is and the way it should be is, we are upset, we are concerned. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 talks about our vehement desire to prove ourselves when we have faltered in the sight of God, how indignant we are toward ourselves because of our ungodliness. But when it comes to the point where that has been taken care of, and now we are in a different state, and that state is reconciliation with God, we are being blessed by his goodness and his mercy. We have the hope of heaven and everlasting life. Boy, that's a time to sing. It's a time to rejoice. And if we're in that state, and I hope and pray that everyone is today, there should not be any unhappy individuals. I don't care what the world throws at you. I don't care how many difficulties you have. It's not that you should be sad or despondent. You should instead be rejoicing with gladness and happiness and joy because we are right with the Lord. And that's the default state that we should have as Christians. So in the spite of trial and tribulation, we are to count it joy when we suffer those things. It's because of where we are and what's going to be there for us. And if we can keep our mind on the goal and what's in the future, if our life is right with God now, it will be something that will cause us to be joyous and to be happy in all things. All right, so those are the things that I wanted to cover in those questions. I think it does a pretty good job at least of giving us some insight on the major lessons. We're not covering all the details, and a lot of these questions are just, okay, what did this verse say, or what did that verse say, or what is the special significant action or thing that happened, and relaying of those things. But I wanted to kind of get this premise out there with regard to the significance of the glorious reward through God for Zion. Yes? Oh, really? Okay. I wasn't aware of that.
They had a special shape to them, and they put walls around them. But they found the one north of Jerusalem, and they found the one down the lake, where the Republican armies came up from.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was fascinating.
That's interesting. Yes, there is a lot of that. You know, one of the things that I often will talk about when I talk to a Mormon, and I know Josh has been dealing with that some, but the significant correlation between archaeology and what the Bible says. Now, it's not always accepted. There are always modernists that will give other explanations of things, or will take issue with something that is lacking because it hasn't been discovered yet. But the fact is, there is significant and abundant evidence, and the prism of Sennacherib is an example of this, or Taylor's prism, which is another copy of the same. These are proofs that what the Bible says happened actually did happen. These occasions did happen. These things did take place. And you don't have any of that in the Mormon religion. When you look at the claims of a people that were existing prior to the European coming in and all, and that they were Mormons and they had received these teachings and all of these kinds of things that were present in the New World, that are not talked about in the Bible, but the Book of Mormon talks about them, there's not that same recognition of archaeological basis and proofs in that work, which is, again, an evidence that it's not legitimate. It's not a valid work, whereas the Bible is proved, I think, and or at least there is evidence. The proving of it is, I think, seen in the miracles and the resurrection from the dead, but there is evidence which supports those things also in archaeology. We don't need or have to have all of these different revelations, but each one we do receive is a bolstering to our faith. Some people think, well, if we can't find Noah's Ark, which some say we already have, some say we haven't, but if we don't find Noah's Ark, that means the Bible's not true. No, that's not true. There's plenty to prove the Bible's true, both internally and externally, with regard to prophecies, with regard to miracles, with regard to the archaeological discoveries already made, and we don't need anything more, but each time we do receive more, it's something that bolsters our faith. So it's a good point to make. Okay, let's get into then the historical interlude in chapters 36 through 39. We're not going to spend or have a lot of time to go through a lot of this, but we do want to spend a little bit of time to note, if you'll notice the objectives in studying the section, this historical interlude is rather pivotal. We talked about how that we're going to be discussing in the first half the Assyrians, and then in the second half the Babylonians, and we're about to get into the Babylonian captivities and the prophecies about that. But in seeing the fulfillment of what we've been talking to up to this point, it's really, really an amazing thing. We've made some allusions to it, but these chapters actually deal specifically with the defeat of Assyria and an event in Hezekiah's life when he became ill and was ill to the point of death, but was, because he prayed to God, given mercy from God and lived for another 15 years as a result of that. But also, it kind of shows the downfall that was coming with regard to Jerusalem, because even though they were spared in the Assyrian captivity, Hezekiah made a mistake. some nice people from Babylon came, and he just showed them around, and he showed them all the good stuff. And I have no doubt they went back and said, hey, there's a lot of good stuff here. Let's go get it, because that's exactly what happened and what God said would happen as a result of what Hezekiah did. So we'll talk a little bit about all of these things in studying it. And basically what we're doing again is looking at the summary. Won't spend any time in the outline per se unless someone has a question. And we'll take some time to look at some of the questions as well. But in that historical interlude, there are two events that are described primarily. The first one is the basic climactic period where the Assyrians fell. We're going to discuss that first. But also, there is a second event which has to do with Hezekiah's illness and then prophecy concerning Babylon that we're going to discuss as well. So this is kind of the transition period from chapters 36 through 39. First couple ending up Assyria, the last two starting up the Babylonian situation. So it's not as obvious or direct a break as might have been indicated by the first lesson when it says 1 through 39 is Assyria and 40 through 66 is Babylon. That's not entirely the case, because there is this interlude that is given here in chapters 36 through 39. So you'll notice in chapters 36 through 37, the prophecies that were foretold all through these passages, and I'm going to read just a couple of them to you again, the fulfillment is seen in these first two chapters that we're going to be discussing concerning Assyria. So let's look and see what was said about Assyria. It's very much a review. You should be familiar with this, but I think I've got about four of the passages that he mentions here that I want to read very quickly. The first one is Isaiah 10, verse 12. Which we are told by Isaiah, it shall come to pass when the Lord has performed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his haughty looks. And so this is early on in the message, but this is the claim that was made that Jerusalem would suffer, but when God finished with causing that suffering for Judah and for Jerusalem, then I'm going to deal with the Assyrians. In Isaiah 14 and verse 24, going through verse 27, Isaiah 14, 24 through 27, the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely, as I have thought, so it shall come to pass, as I have purposed, so it shall stand. There we go again, talking about God's sovereignty. It's going to happen because I said it was going to happen. I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains tread him underfoot. His yoke shall be removed from them, from Jerusalem, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed against the whole earth. And this is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations. Again, you see it? Just how sovereign and preeminent and powerful that God is. The Lord, a God of hosts, has purposed. Who's going to annul it? His hand is stretched out. Who will turn it back? Men are impotent with regard to what God determines to do. That's one of the things that I'm going to be talking, the material that we studied in the book of Revelation, I was asked when we finished our study of James this particular Thursday, and that study I'm having on Thursdays, that they wanted to study Revelation next, which, you know, a lot of people like to do that. It's not the one that we really need to be studying, but I've got my way for a lot, so I thought, okay, we'll study Revelation. But they're going to be talking about premillennialism, aren't they? Well, one of the primary problems that I have with the premillennial theory, as it predominantly exists in the world, is that God intended to establish his kingdom in the first century, but was precluded from doing so because of the rejection of the Jews. In other words, men kept God from doing what God wanted to do. Well, this passage teaches very clearly that doesn't happen. God did exactly what he intended to do. There is no question about this. There's no way of thwarting the will of God. God does what God determines to do. In Isaiah 30 and 31, Isaiah chapter 30, verses 30 and 31, we're told the Lord will cause his glorious voice to be heard, Show the descent of his arm with the indignation of his anger and the flame of a devouring fire with scattering tempest and hailstones. For through the voice of the Lord, Assyria will be beaten down as he strikes with a rod. Again, keep this in mind. Promise made. We are told in chapters 36 and 37 that it actually happened. And also related in 1 Kings chapter 18 through 20. But also we can look in secular history to find out that's exactly what did happen. And then finally in Isaiah 31 verses 8 through 9, Assyria shall fall by a sword, not of man, and a sword not of mankind shall devour him. But he shall flee from the sword, his young men shall become forced labor, he shall cross over his stronghold for fear, and his princes shall be afraid of the banner, says the Lord, whose fire is in Zion and whose furnace is in Jerusalem. And I just love those passages as they establish, and this is typical of the words of prophecy. It's not that this may happen or that it could happen. When God had determined it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And it stated with force that that's exactly what's going to happen. And it did. It's exactly how God said, because God determined it. I mean, there are examples that we can turn where God relented what he was going to do. That means he changed his mind, not in the sense that he is vacillating in any way, but it's always been the case that God gives an opportunity. He's long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish. He's going to continue to give us opportunities up until a certain point in time, till it's everlastingly too late. Well, when Jonah went and preached to the Nineveh, it wasn't too late. Because they repented in sackcloth and ashes, he relented what he was going to do. He decided not to do it anymore. With the judgment of God upon the world in the days of the flood, he could have destroyed mankind utterly, couldn't he? But because there was one righteous man with his family, he spared them and replenished the earth with Noah and his children and his family, to the extent that we're all descendants of Noah today, aren't we, in that regard. So these kinds of things will happen if God determines that they'll happen, if he allows such things to happen. But he wasn't going to do that with Assyria, so it was absolute. This is what's going to happen to Assyria. And it stated with force, and it stated with confidence. And that's one of the reasons why Hezekiah could trust that what was going to happen is going to happen. Because his trust in the Lord came as a result of his knowledge of God's power. And we'll talk about that a little bit when we get into the statements of the Rabshakeh. And that's in our next section. So look at this. In the 14th year, this is in the summary, of King Hezekiah, which is about 701 B.C., Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, was capturing the fortified cities of Judah. So he had already gone through Syria and Israel. Now he's coming into Judah. He's ravaging the land of Judah. He's not slowing down. He's just as bad for them as it was for Israel. But then he gets to Jerusalem. Well, he sent the Rabshakeh to Jerusalem. And if you want to know who the Rabshakeh was, his purpose was to persuade Hezekiah. We're told in doing so he blasphemes the Lord. We'll read that example there. The term Rabshakeh, some think it's his name, but in most of the translations, it is referred to as a title. And that's why the is there, the article there, the. So instead of saying, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib sent Rabshakeh, which would be okay, well, that's the name of a man named Rabshakeh, but it's the Rabshakeh, which is basically the word means the chief of the princes. And so he was an important man. It is translated in the NIV as the field commander. It's translated in the New Living Translation as the chief of staff, the Assyrian chief of staff. Now not a translation, that's a paraphrase, so I don't like that too much. But the idea of the field commander or the royal spokesman, we're not exactly sure what the name specifically implies, but let's just stop and say he was somebody real important speaking for the king. So we could say perhaps a diplomat. I haven't, there's a movie out that some of you possibly have seen on television. I haven't watched the whole thing, but there was one particular scene that I've seen. It's called The 300, so some of you may be familiar with it. But you have on that the Greeks that are fighting the Persians, and you have the guy that from Persia that comes as an emissary of the king, and he's sitting by the open pit, and he's really insulting the Greeks. He's basically saying, I've got a great king, and he's like a god, and do what he tells you to do, but you're just these poor, measly people that have no chance of defeating him, and we're going to destroy you if you don't surrender. And the guy got real mad at him and kicked him into the well. So I don't know if you've seen that picture of it, but very insulting. And that's exactly the way the Rabshakeh was on this particular occasion. Let's look at a couple of examples of this, and we can go both in Isaiah and I'm going to pretty much stay there, but a little bit later when we look at the destruction of the Assyrians, I'm going to go to 2 Kings 19 to relate it so you can see the familiarity with it. But notice Isaiah chapter 36 and verse 4. What the Rabshakeh said there in Jerusalem. He tells them, he says, say to your king, talk to Hezekiah, say to him, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria. What confidence in this is this in which you trust? I say, you speak of having plans and power for war, but they're mere words. Now, in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. Now, that's kind of a figurative, very figurative language, very vivid language he's talking about. So, you guys, you think that you got some power, you might have some ability to withstand the king of Assyria? I'm telling you now, the ones you're depending upon is Egypt. Egypt's like a broken reed. So you have this, and the broken reed, let's take maybe some, what's the cane? Sugar cane? Not sugar cane. Eucalypt? No. What was it we had in our front yard? Oh, never mind. Bamboo, thank you, okay. Debbie looked at me like crazy. We did maybe 30 years ago, but we had some bamboo in our front yard, we had to do it. So let's say a broken reed of bamboo, you know, and it's there, so there's a little bit of girth to it or a little bit of substantial aspects to it, but you lean on that and it just goes right through your hand because it's sharp, but it's not going to help you at all. It's a hindrance, it's not a help, and that's kind of the picture he's getting. So you're depending upon somebody who basically is not going to help you. You're trusting in the staff of a broken reed on which if a man leans, it will go into his hands and pierce it. And that's the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to all who trust him. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, well, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you should worship before this altar? And didn't Hezekiah do that? That's amazing. That's kind of an amazing thing about this. This may indicate that what Hezekiah did is some of the reforms, and some of the kings of Judah did this, where they destroyed the high places. Understand, the high places that existed in Judah as well as Israel were sometimes used for pagan sacrifices, but not always. They were also used, were they not, as Jehoshaphat said, for convenience. And the purpose, the plan of God was for the people to come to Jerusalem. The altar to God was found in the most holiest place, the holiest of holies there in Jerusalem. And that's where God is to be worshipped. But they had practiced the high places. There were times when some kings served God and they stayed away from the pagans, and yet they did not tear down the high places that had been built. Well, Hezekiah comes along, he tears down the high places. I imagine that not all the people were happy about that. Because now, I just can't go down the street to worship God. I'm going to have to make a long trek down to the city of Jerusalem to do so. Wasn't that far, but they had to walk. So it could be a problem, couldn't it? You realize that there is the same problem today? People are just not willing to take the time to travel just a little bit to serve God. There's a reason why there are congregations, like for example, we've got the Woodmont congregation in the south of the city. Farther south, we've got the Alvareda congregation. You go out west, you've got Weatherford, and maybe southwest, you have Granbury. And you go up north, and there may be North Beach or Northwest now. We've got the West Side Church of Christ, and it's because people don't want to drive very far. I appreciate all of you who travel a good distance to come and to worship here. It means an absolute lot to me because there's only a few of us left in River Oaks area. I appreciate your willingness to do so. But can you imagine how convenient it would be to have a place to worship God that's just down the street or just very, very close, and you would be pleasing God just as much as a result of that? Well, Hezekiah said, no more. It's not going to happen anymore. And he said, you know, that's the Lord that you are depending upon. That's the one that Hezekiah has taken away the high places and the altars. And he said, you have to come worship here. Well, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able on your part to put riders on them. Look at these. Look at this mercy. Look at all these blessings. Now, notice again Isaiah 36. Isaiah 36 and verse 13. We're told that Rabshakeh stood. He called out with a loud voice in Hebrew. He said, hear the words of the great king of the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, don't let Hezekiah deceive you. He's their king. Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. He won't be able to deliver you. And you can imagine that maybe this would have caused fear. It did certainly for Hezekiah. He had those self-doubts, but the people as well. They said, the people who were in charge kind of in Jerusalem, don't speak loudly. Let's do this in private. Let's talk in private. And he said, why? Rabshakeh said, why? Are you afraid of what I got to say? I'm going to tell. He talks to the people. He said, you people, listen to me. Don't listen to what Hezekiah is saying to you. Because he's not going to be able to help you, deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. And here's the blasphemy that is mentioned in the text. Notice this. Hezekiah is going to say this: the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given in the hand of the king of Assyria. And the Rabshakeh says this: do not listen, Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present. Come out to me, and every one of you will eat from his own vine, every one from his own fig tree. Every one of you will drink the waters of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a new land, like your own land. It's got grain and new wine. It's a land of bread and vineyards. So he says, we're gonna, in effect, take care of you, but this land is mine, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. Now, if you come out and surrender, we're going to take you away, but you'll be able to keep your stuff until you go away, and we'll replace it with other decent stuff. And that's kind of the way they did. The Assyrians, they would replace things. It wasn't as nice as what he's saying, of course, is it? But he says here, notice this, in verse 18, beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? No. Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand? But the Lord. Now remember, the Lord, that's the actual name of God. So let's, instead of saying the Lord, let's say Jehovah in this case. So these gods haven't happened. So since they have not delivered the countries from my hand, who is Jehovah that he should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? So isn't that arrogant? Isn't that prideful? Typical. It's typical of the Pharaoh. It's typical of him during the Exodus and other. I'm in control. I'm like a god. Look how great I am. And you're not going to be able to overcome me. But again, we know that's not the case. We see it in the fulfillment here, and we see it in God's sovereignty in other ways. And so I think the message here primarily is people are not very smart. But it's understandable somewhat. Assyria wants it. Assyria is going to get it. Assyria went on until basically they were stopped, and they weren't stopped by man. They were stopped by the Lord himself. And so Assyria, King Sennacherib, he went back to Assyria and never came back to Jerusalem again. About 13, 14 years later, he was killed as he was worshiping his God. His sons killed him. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But that, anyway, it's just an interesting thing, these words and the language. You can go to 2 Kings and you'll see the exact same discourse of the Rabshakeh given in that place as is in here. So it is an interesting thing when you look at 2 Kings 18 through 20 and these things, how the narratives correlate and how there are references. Oh, Isaiah said this. So the king, this chronicler, or the chronicler of the kings, he's stating that, and we see it actually being said by Isaiah here. So we'll get into that a little bit more in our discussion next week. Anybody have any final comments or questions? Appreciate it. We'll pick up there where we left off.